And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nowhere else to go!
I got nothing else.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here, I was going to say as always, but it's so far from always, with my good buddy, one of my bestest friends, Mr. Scott Gardner. How you doing?
I am a man barely alive, barely awake, There you go.
We are going to probably have a relatively short show today because I'm going to pull back the curtain and let you know immediately. First of all, we are doing this in the wee hours of the morning on daylight savings time. So I had to virtually drag Scott out of bed from hundreds of miles away in order to get him available to do this, first of all. And second of all, we're trying a new recording system since Skype is going away. And we are concerned that if we go long, we'll waste a show if it doesn't record right. So you're gonna get what you get, and don't get upset.
Do you know where Ben Franklin is buried? Because I'd like to dig him up and thank him personally for this daylight savings bullshit. So,
It is. I hate the daylight savings. And they always say, it's for the farmers. What farmers? I live in a concrete jungle.
It's for the birds is what it is. Ugh. Anyway.
Well, you know what? I would rather stay on this particular end of it, though, because it makes it easier for me to deal with my dogs. But, you know, just the same pain in the ass. Anyway, so we're gonna go relatively quickly today. So
real quick, where's your phone right now?
It's right in front of me.
Is it close to your mic?
It's not that far. Why, are we getting some sort of echo or something?
Yeah, that thing.
My phone shouldn't be picking me up.
Yeah, I've never had that happen, like when we were using Skype or whatever, so I'm not sure. But it was doing that weird crackly thing that I know it's done to me before when I've been using my handheld digital recorder and I forget and set my phone right next to it. I think it was just picking something up. Possibly. Either that or maybe it's just maybe it's this new system. I don't know. These are the bugs we'll be working out, folks, but
maybe it's just annoying. But we will work out the bugs. And, we'll hopefully, with this is all in an effort to keep use people entertained. So what do we got today, Scott?
You want me to go first on this?
I don't care. It's up to you.
All right. I will go ahead.
I liked my book more than I like yours, so I think
yes.
For that reason, it might be better to go with yours.
Okay. That works. I feel much the same way. So, all right, let me pull up my notes here, and let's dive right into this sucker. All right, so I have the first book. My book is from Marvel Comics. This is The Shroud, number one. Cover date on this was March of 1994. On sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, was January 11th, 1994. Cover on this one is by M.C. Wyman with inks by Malcolm Jones. And it depicts the Shroud. He's standing in a lot or something. It almost looks like he's rising up out of the dust or out of a smoky thing or something. He's kind of like standing there making a pose, rising up or whatever, and Spider-Man is swinging in behind him, a very bulky, overly musculatured, Spider-Man that's really been working on leg day with a tiny little command module head. It's You know, actually, I think it's not bad, except for Spider-Man. Spider-Man's, he might be the thing that's, you know, they're trying to do to bump up, you know, you're noticing it on the stands or whatever. But yeah, he kind of detracts, actually. But otherwise, yeah, it's not a bad image. I think the sky could be a different color, but then again, that would maybe contrast with the shroud. I don't know. But anyway, it's a decent enough cover. Cover price on this was $1.75, which I'm trying to think. In 1994, was that a good price? Was that a standard price? Was that maybe a little high? I can't remember.
I would suspect that I don't know why, but for some reason I'm thinking $1.50 was standard.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So this might be a little bit expensive for the times, but I can't quite recall. But anyway, cover copy on this says "At last, the Master of Darkness in his own limited series," and then with the Spider-Man portion, Spider-Man, ally or enemy. Anyway, the title on this story is "The Deadly Past." It is the writer on this is Mike Barr, also known as Mike W. Barr. Penciler again is Wyman, who did the cover, and inker is Jones, who inked the cover. So here's the synopsis on this one, folks. In New York City, the Shroud leaps into the middle of an exchange of gunfire between two factions of assholes who've had some sort of illicit deal go sour. They immediately taser him instead of just ventilating him for some reason, and he quickly recovers and starts laying into them while his employees, I guess, a hulking black man named Cat and a slinky white girl named Mouse, monitor the situation from a nearby battle van. Cat and Mouse wonder why they're even here and not back in their regular stomping grounds of Los Angeles, and why Shroud is getting involved in this whole thing in the first place. One of the faction's leaders, Garrick King, tries to split the scene, but Shroud pursues him to his home where he blackmails / recruits him, I guess. Later, Shroud catches up with Cat and Mouse in a dumpy apartment in Manhattan, where he goes into another room to brood over the mysterious papyrus scroll that was sent to him anonymously and put him on this case to begin with. A scroll bearing the seal of Kali, the same seal he himself wears on his forehead. A flashback ensues in which we learn that the Shroud's life began by nicking Batman's origin. Thomas and Martha Wayne look-alike parents gunned down by Joe Chill look-alike gunmen, swearing vengeance at their graves, obsession with becoming the best crime fighter of his generation, studying criminology, and eventually traveling to the Far East. But this is where the origins of the Batman and the Shroud diverge. Whereas Bruce Wayne trained in the Far East, learning martial arts, etc., the Shroud got wrapped up in a nutty cult that, yes, trained him how to fight, but also branded his face and put his eyes out. So then he was forced to nick some of Daredevil's shtick, and he soon discovers that while now blind, his other senses have become enhanced, yada, 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 and he can perceive all around him in all directions, even through solid walls. And has even acquired the ability to create and master darkness somehow. There's even a brief mention of his time as the leader of the night shift and how he created a persona for himself as a gang lord to get criminals to accept him as one of their... Wait. Isn't that the Green Hornet's whole gag? Goddamn, man. Why doesn't this guy just go ahead and wear a red S on his chest, shoot webs, and have a magic ring too? Anyway, the next day, Inspector Coringold goes to see a Mr. Lassiter about something. And after their awkward exchange, Lassiter picks up the phone and calls the Scorpion and offers him a job. Meanwhile, at the scene of last night's skirmish, Peter Parker is trying to get the skinny on what went down. A tip puts him on the trail of Garrick King, and he's off and web swinging and apparently knows right where King lives because somehow he goes straight there. Flip the page, and Spidey arrives just in time to stop the Scorpion from killing King, who was out for a jog. Spidey takes the Scorpion, a villain that has proven to be a worthy and challenging opponent on many, many occasions, out with one kick like a total mort. Spider-Man leaves Scorpion laying in the street to chase after the gang in the car that Scorpion was riding in, as they try to run and gun King down. Shroud arrives and battles the revived Scorpion while Spider-Man alights on the hood of the gangster's car, distracting the driver and causing them to crash in what clearly looks to be like a fatal accident. Concerned about having just left Scorpion unchaperoned, Spidey returns to where he left him, only to discover Scorpion fighting the Shroud in a darkened gas station garage. Scorpion attacks, and the two heroes, unaccustomed to working together, trip each other up and wind up trapped as the Scorpion rigs up an acetylene flame that will ignite spilled, spreading gasoline and incinerate our hero, our incapacitated heroes. Next issue, boom! Right out of the gate, I gotta say, what a disappointment this was. I have collected this series over the years out of the cheap bins.
In other words, they gave you money to take them home.
Yeah. And was very happy to finally score the last issue. I need. It's only a 4-issue mini. I don't even remember what the last issue was that I needed, but not long ago, I finally scored and I was like, oh, good. I can finally sit down and read this. And then I sat down to read it and I was like, oh.
It's, you know that, like when you go to make a Skype call and the person isn't there, and at the end you hear, ooh. It's almost like that sound. It's almost like that sound came when you read this book.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. You know, just horrible disappointment because I can't remember now where I met the Shroud. I should have done more homework on this for like his history and all, but
I know I met the Shroud in Supervillain Team Up number 5, which I believe was his first appearance. And at that point, he seemed like he had potential to be a pretty cool character.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know, Daredevil combined with Batman. It was really just the two of them, Daredevil and Batman at that point. At least that's the way it seemed to me. And I thought, you know, there was some potential there to have some fun with this character and make him really cool. Here, first of all, like you say, they kind of use up everybody. You know, once he gets into the cult, he's stealing Iron Fist's origin. you know, it's just too much crap in here. But the biggest thing for me, quite frankly, is I can't stand the artwork in this book.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know, we've talked about before how, you know, you are an art first guy, whereas I'm kind of 50-50 art and story. And usually when the art is disappointing like this, I can, you know, if I fight my way through and it's a good story, I'm okay. But this story didn't do anything for me either.
Well, that's where maybe we're going to diverge just a little bit, because I honestly think that there's at least the bones of a really good story here. I think if the art supported the story more, I think there's something here, but unfortunately I really think, yes, he's borrowing stuff from all over the place. So I don't know how strong a character that makes him when he's not really that unique. He's kind of piecemealed together from other characters' origins type of thing. But that aside, I kind of think I understand what Barr is going for. And I have to say right out of the gate, Mike Barr is one of my favorite writers, especially when he was doing Batman. And so I think this was, you know, here he was getting a chance to kind of do a Marvel version of Batman, you know, and maybe do something Batman-ish. Kind of, you know, his shtick, you know, what Barr was used to, but, you know, in the Marvel universe. But unfortunately, the art just really doesn't support the story at all in so many ways. And yeah, you're right. I'm a visual first guy. Unfortunately, you know, I've always been that way. And when it comes to things like this, where the art is just so weak and again, not supporting the story, it just kind of ruined the experience for me. And what I mean by not supporting the story is not only, I mean, I don't want to just completely dump on MC Wyman, because I do kind of like the guy. I don't care for the art in this particular issue, but I have seen art from him before that I kind of like. His style is, I don't know, I see several different artist style within his own style, you know, other artists that I really like. So I kind of see where he has potential to be, you know, a really great artist. And I have seen better work from him than this. But what I mean by not supporting the story is that there are things that happen in the art that are just like really weird. Like I made a note here on, where was it? Okay, page 7 of the story. King gets in that truck and he's driving away. And you see in the third panel where the shroud leaps onto the driver's side of the vehicle and literally puts his fist through the side, you know, the driver's side window to punch him right in the face. But then look at the next panel. The shroud is not on the vehicle and the window is unbroken. And I'm like, what the hell? I mean, there's absolutely no continuity in the art whatsoever. And it was stuff like that. When I noticed things like that, it just completely takes me out of the story. And then I'm a lot less forgiving of the art, because then I don't see it so much as, oh, this is just this guy's style, as this guy was rushing and just didn't really give a shit about the project that he was working on. And that's kind of what this made me feel like at the end of the day, was that I don't think the guy's heart's in the story, you know? And that's a shame, because again, I think there was, you know, the potential for this to be a really good bang up first issue setting the stage, but instead it was one of those kind of things where, like, I don't even know if I want to continue reading this now, because it was that lackluster, you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's when it comes to series like this, and we're going to see the follow-up on this on our next book, a lot of times when I finish off, my thought process is, do I want to continue to the next issue? You know, it's one thing when we do a done in one issue story, that's one thing. But when we do one where it's a continued story and we're doing the first issue of the story, then that question enters greatly into my grading of the book ultimately, is did it make me want to continue reading it? And frankly, no, it didn't. Now, you know, it's funny because Gene Hendricks and I just recently were waxing poetic about Mike W. Barr, because we just concluded his maxi series on Camelot 3000, which we both loved. So certainly I have no criticism of his writing ability. And I do think this, as you say, that he's somewhat betrayed by the art, where if the art was better in this, I think the story would flow better. Just the same, I don't feel like he gives us any reason to want to root for the Shroud. He doesn't give us any reason to want to go with this team he's got together. So that's the writing on it. And then in the artwork, I do see some layout things that I think if it was rendered in a style that I like, I would enjoy much more. I had gone to page 23 of the story and thought, if this was in a style that I liked, that is not a bad layout at all. It's kind of cool. It almost right. has a little bit of a cinematic feel to it. And the artwork on that page actually is not as bad as it is on other pages. So that page stood out to me as one of the best pages in the book. You go next to page 26, which is the next page of the story. The artwork there, or the layout there, feels like he's trying to do too much. That it becomes almost confusing in the way it's laid out. So, you know, I'm not really familiar with M.C. Weinman. I think I've probably read other things that he's drawn, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what they were. But the art style in this just seems to reek of 1990s.
Yeah.
And the 1990s that I don't like. And I've defended the 90s in the past in some of our conversations, and you have as well, because it gets the reputation of everything was crap in the 1990s, which is not true. There was a lot of good stuff that came out. But the problem is, in an effort to put out much more content, which is clearly what they were doing, they allowed some substandard projects to go out. I don't think that this would have been approved in the 80s or 70s. I think they would have looked at this artwork and said, wait a minute, you know, go redo this. When we meet the what is it, cat and what is it, mouse or
cat and mouse? Yeah,
yeah. Look, I mean, look on the page 4 when they introduced Cat. I mean, the guy is, he's the Hulk.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, you know, it just doesn't look right. Where is she? He looks like he weighs 350 pounds or 400 pounds, and she looks like she weighs 10.
Right.
You know, it's just not appealing to me. It doesn't look right to me. And I hadn't even noticed what you mentioned about the broken window in the car and the lack of detail there. I might put that on the inker, who is Malcolm Jones, who I'm also unfamiliar with. You know, I don't know if that's something where Wyman left it for him to kind of just fill in something with the broken window. I don't know. But I, you know, the artwork really took me out of this story. I just didn't appreciate it. And again, the story, I think the character has potential to kind of be fun to read, but I think there's too much of an effort to make this into Frank Miller's Daredevil type feel with it not being successfully done.
Right. So right.
It really just didn't do anything for me at all. I was looking at on page 19, the bottom left panel, the way Inspector Korngold is drawn. He looks like a comic, like Louis Anderson or like a combination of Louis Anderson and Ralph Cramden.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, he doesn't look like the hard boiled detective that I think they want you to think. I don't know. It's just the art really betrayed this book. I think the story was not, again, you know, like when I mentioned it earlier, I said I can get by the bad art if the story is strong enough. This story is not strong enough to get by the art. The story is okay. I think with better art, I would have said, you know, maybe I'm interested in seeing the next issue. I also didn't like, as you mentioned earlier, how Spider-Man took out Scorpion with one punch. You know, how do you, in the same story, recover from that? You have him, or one kick, rather. He gets one kick, he's unconscious, but then we're supposed to see him as a viable opponent for the Shroud?
Exactly. Yeah, that was, I mean, by this point in the story, I was already kind of like, I'm not really feeling this, but that was the point that kind of broke me where I'm like, come on, the Scorpion's a badass. You know, every story I've ever read with the Scorpion, you know, he's considered one of Spider-Man's major opponents. You know, he always struggled with him. And in this one, it's like one kick in the whatever underarm and he's down. And I'm like, what? And this was actually, at this point with this costume, isn't this where Gargan had undergone like some sort of enhancement beyond his original Scorpion form? Like he had like now like a tougher armor and.
Yeah, and I think it's more armored. And if you could even see on his tail, he's got like a spike.
Right.
There was definitely the upgrade to try and make him into a more compelling bad guy.
Yeah.
He certainly didn't achieve that here.
No, not at all. Not at all. So yeah, I was disappointed by this.
And again, I have no desire to read issue 2 at this point.
The only thing that makes me, and believe me, this is going to the bottom of the pile, so it's not anything I'm going to get to anytime soon, but the only thing that kind of makes me want to finish this series is that I kind of wonder what the story is behind the scenes on this whole thing, because it's only a 4-issue mini. The art team does change on the 4th issue, which I was kind of surprised to see that on a 4-issue miniseries. But the art in the last issue is actually pretty damn good. It's by what's this guy's name? Hopefully I didn't close
Williams.
The window on this. Yeah, it's listed as A. Williams. It's actually Anthony Williams is the penciler. And then inks by Jones again, but he's also assisted by Scott Koblish, who I really like. So between the three of them, the art in the last issue is much, much better. And I really kind of dig the art in the last issue. So maybe it gets good at the very end. I don't know, but at least the art is better in that last issue. But again, I don't know if that's enough of an enticement to make me want to have to slog through 2 more issues of this, you know, visuals like in this first issue. So, Yeah.
I probably will never know if I'm going to like that last artwork.
What's that?
I said, I doubt I'm ever going to find out if I'm going to like the artwork in the end. Because it's just, I don't see myself. I have surprisingly less time to read than I thought I was going to at this point. And I think it's because I read a couple of issues and I still enjoy reading my comics very much. But I read a few issues and it's like, okay, I'm going to put this down now and do something else with my day. So I don't find that I'm reading comics as many hours a day or as many minutes a day, whatever it may be, as I would have if this was 20 years ago. And it's, again, it's not that I don't enjoy them. I have other things that distract me and take me away from it. So when I'm trying to budget my time, I really try to stick to things I think I'm going to like. And this, I'm not enticed to read the next issue of this. So why spend, you know, my limited comic book reading budget on it?
Right. No, I get that. I totally get that. I've got too many other reading projects going on that I really intend to finish that, yeah, something like this, as I say, it goes immediately to the bottom of the pile, unfortunately. I had a question for you and for the audience as well. I'm hoping somebody might know the answer to this. So I'm intrigued by, it's not even really a panel because it's like a flashback dream sequence kind of thing, but page 18, bottom portion of that page talks about the Shroud's time as the leader, I guess, of the Night Shift. And it shows all these different characters, one of which appears to be the Frankenstein monster. Mm-hmm. Now, I tried to look at the Night Shift. What's that?
Yeah, in the background. Yeah, I definitely see him.
So I tried to look up the Night Shift, and I couldn't find a lot of information about them. And it did not list the Frankenstein monster as a member of the team. And I thought I had a pretty complete collection of the appearances of the Frankenstein monster. I never even heard of this team before. So I'm wondering, is that really him? Is that a different character that just kind of looks like him? Did he maybe pop into one of their appearances? I wonder what the whole story is here. And
I am not familiar at all with this particular group.
Yeah, me either. I'd never heard of them before.
While you're talking about it, I'm trying to look it up and see if I can find anything that makes sense. And so far, not really. Here we go. They have a Wikipedia page. Did you already look at this?
Probably, but what's it say about them?
So based in California, the group is gathered and initially controlled by the Shroud. He is assisted by the Werewolf, misleading the team into believing they're forming a criminal gang when in reality they're acting as vigilantes. The team's original lineup consists of Brothers Grimm, Dance Macabre, Digger, and Gypsy Moth. The Needle, the Shroud, Tatter, Demalion, TikTok, and the Werewolf. So he's definitely not an initial character, according to this.
Yeah.
Just looking for a mention of Frankenstein's monster, and I don't see it at all.
You know what I didn't do is I didn't look at the Frankenstein monsters Marvel wiki. I wonder if it's mentioned in his that he was a member of this team or what. But yeah, again, I don't recall that. But I do remember there was a gap between like where I kind of lost track of him. And then when he reappeared in that Elsa Bloodstone mini. Right. So maybe during that time he was, but.
No,
even his Wikipedia says much the same thing. It talks about, you know, how he kind of wandered around the Marvel universe after he lost his series, you know, like he teamed up with Spider-Man and Marvel team up. And he was in an arc of Iron Man right around the 100, you know, the 100 issue of Iron Man. And then I kind of lost track of him. And then that's kind of where the wiki picks up as well, is when he was later working for Elsa Bloodstone. So yeah, that doesn't make any mention of this team either. So I don't know who the hell this character is in the background of this shot. So I don't know. Yeah, no, I know out there somewhere there's one of those Marvel chronology projects where you can punch in different characters. That site is really cool. If you guys have never found that, I'll see if I can find what the. Yeah, whenever I search it out, I can never find the damn thing. But there's a site out there that's a really, really thoroughly researched and comprehensive chronology site for Marvel characters. Where you can just punch in different characters, and it'll give you their whole appearance history. And it's really authoritative, and they really get into some obscure characters. If I can find that site again, I'll punch in the Frankenstein monster and see if I could find it. But anyway, yeah, I was just curious about that. You know, this is one of those instances where, you know, normally when a story like this does that thing where they put the little label on all the different characters in a scene like that, sometimes that really bugs me because it kind of takes me out of it. But in this particular instance, I kind of wish they had done that, because I don't really recognize any of the other characters that are here. I recognize this one guy was supposed to be a werewolf character, but I don't know which werewolf he was supposed to be. I don't know if he's like Werewolf by Night or anybody. Well, and then there's the guy that looks like a... Huh?
So to the right of Frankenstein's monster is Gypsy Moth. I recognize right. that. Down diagonally to the right is one of the brothers Grimm.
Right.
The werewolf is at the bottom left. I don't know who that is next to him. To his right.
Yeah, he looks like a cross between like Clayface and like Bagman or something. I don't know what the hell that's supposed
to be. And I'm not sure who is directly behind the werewolf.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who is directly to the left of one of the brothers Grimm, and I don't know who's above him. So, my knowledge on this era, I guess, is lacking.
I wonder if the guy behind, I wonder if that, is that Cat and Mouse? The two, the big guy right in front of what looks to be the Frankenstein monster behind the werewolf, and then the girl to the shade, to the side of the shade. I wonder if that's supposed to be Cat and Mouse. I wonder if they were part of the team at this time.
I could not tell you.
I don't know. Because that guy is really big, like Cat is shown to be in the very beginning of the book, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who any of these people are.
I don't know them. I don't want them coming to my home. So,
here it is. I think I found it. Is this the site I'm thinking it is? Yeah, this is it. Yeah, the address for this is really weird. It's actually, I think if you look up Complete Marvel Reading Order, because it has it as an acronym here, CMRO.travis-stearns.com, blah, blah, blah. There's a whole address thing here that's a nightmare, but I think if you were to look up Complete Marvel Reading Order, that's the thing I was talking about. I'm trying to figure out. Oh, here it is. The characters. Let's see. Is there? Yeah, this has got like. I mean, it's insane how many characters are in this thing. I mean, it seemingly has every. All right, here we go. Frankenstein's monster. All right. Not sure how fascinating a listening this is, but I'm just curious on. Yeah, there's nothing. So the last appearance of Frankenstein's monster, according to this, which usually is very, very dead on, he appeared in 1977 in Iron Man 102, and then not again until Doctor Strange Sorcerer Supreme number 37 in 92, and then again in Spider-Man Unlimited in 98, and then that Elsa Bloodstone series in 2001. So this is not the Frankenstein monster in this team, unless it's some sort of... Well, no, it couldn't be a retcon, because this is 94.
Well, So. I never read this Elsa Bloodstone thing. Did you?
You know, I kicked myself for this. So a weird story about the Elsa Bloodstone thing. I totally chanced across it in either 50 cent or dollar bins. Like I picked it up dirt cheap, and I only picked it up because it had the Frankenstein monster in it. Picked it up, the whole four series, you know, the whole four issues and everything, stuck in a box, for totally forgot about it. And then I forget how, somehow or other, I learned that the thing had like crazy skyrocketed. So I slapped it up on eBay with a cheap starting price, and it sold for some insane amount of money. And then I just kind of put it out of my mind. But that thing has continued to climb. I'm not sure where it's at now, but the last time I looked at it, I could have easily sold it for like 10 times of what I sold for it. And I was already pretty pleased with what I sold it for in the first place. I don't know what the deal is with Elsa Bloodstone, but she just like ballooned into this huge popular character. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if it was a TV show or video game or what, but yeah, she just all of a sudden exploded. And I never even heard of her before.
Probably the Werewolf by Night, special that they did with the MCU.
Oh, well, no, this was way before all that though. Huh? But I mean, yeah, she was in that, or at least her father was. Was she in that as well? Because I know her father
was. I'm not sure.
But yeah, and one of the reasons after I acquired it that I just kind of forgot about it and stuck it in a box is that I never actually sat and read it. I kind of thumbed through it. The art was okay, but it really gave me like a, it was a TNA book. It gave me a strong, like Tomb Raider vibe. Like they were, you know, 'cause she's way over sexualized in that. And, I don't know. It was almost like borderline creepy, 'cause she was drawn like to be like really like a young girl, but she's like way sexed up, and I don't know. It was just kind of strange. And then Frankenstein's monster was very odd in it, because he was very articulate. He was almost working like a Lurch type of character, like the butler for the mansion or something like that. I don't know. It was just really weird. But that's without me ever having actually like sat and read it, but just kind of thumbed through it type of thing. But
gotcha.
But yeah, finding that finding those issues now, it's, yeah, you won't find them in 50 cent boxes, that's for sure. Let's see, do I have any other notes on this? No, my only other note really was about that Korngold character, because he's obviously to me a take on like Harvey Bullock. Didn't Barr create him? I think Barr created Harvey Bullock, didn't he?
I'm not sure. I don't.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But
you're out of my wheelhouse with that. So I can't tell you.
But yeah, ultimately the big sum up for me on this is that I was just really disappointed. No, according to Wikipedia, Doug Mensch, Howard Chaykin, Archie Goodwin, and Don Newton created Harvey Bullock. So no, he did not. Well, whatever. But yeah, as I was saying, just disappointed, because I like the Shroud. Again, I don't remember exactly where I met the guy. It might have been Supervillain Team Up. But yeah, I always thought he was kind of cool. And then wasn't he, for a time, he was involved with Spider-Woman, wasn't he? Like around the time of like Civil War and all that? I kind of seem to recall he was in like one of the side series or something of Civil War.
That's vaguely familiar, so possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, really I think he's a cool character with potential, but yeah, this just did not do it for me, sadly.
Agreed. So you want to give a rating?
Yeah, let's do grades on this. All right. Cover on this, I think if you took Spider-Man off of it, I think you got a pretty, you know, pretty decent cover. I really like the cover. Again, the sky, it's just too bright, but I'm not sure what you could really do with it, because then if you darken it, the Shroud himself is already a dark character emerging from a dark cloud. So I don't know what you could really do to change it or improve it. But, But yeah, but you know, with Spider-Man in there, and Spider-Man just, I'm sorry, he just looks bad. His legs are absolutely ginormous. That one leg, what would that be? His left leg. His left leg is as big as his entire body, his entire torso. It's ridiculous. So yeah, that drags it down. I'm gonna say a B minus, which is probably being super generous, but I like the rest of the cover. That's the problem, is I really do like the rest of it. I just don't like how Spider-Man looks. So yeah, I'll say a B minus. I think that's being very generous. The interior art, this is where this really takes the hit, is on the art. I'm sorry, MC Wyman. I generally like this guy's stuff, but I just did not like the art in this. It looks very rushed. It looks way too stylized. The anatomy is all over the place. People go from having homunculus bodies with little tiny, teeny tiny heads to, I mean, just all kinds of weirdness. And then the portions, and I know there were other instances where there was a lack of continuity in the art. I just didn't really make note of them. But yeah, just all kinds of problems. Spider-Man, I'm not sure Spider-Man ever looks good in any of the scenes here. He's off in just about every one of them. I didn't really care for the way the Scorpion was depicted, and he's actually one of my favorite Spider-Man villains. So yeah, it was just top to bottom, I just really was let down by the art on this. So art-wise, I hate to say it, I'm going to go a D on the art. I think the art was really, really rough in this one. Sorry. And then story-wise, that's a tough one, because I kind of like the story and I kind of liked what it was setting up and where it was going and what I think it was trying to do. So story wise, I'm going to say I'll go a C plus, because again, you know, it's this marriage of story and art, and it's hard to kind of pull the story out of the art with this one. But I think there were elements, pieces that could have come together to be really good and really intriguing. But at the end of the day, you know, as a product as a whole, grade for the entire book, I'm actually going to go a C minus on this one. And again, that's probably being kind of generous. So I don't know. What did you think?
I'm tough, because I don't want to be overly harsh. You know, sometimes when we deal with some of these books, when it's a style I don't like, I feel like I'm afraid of being overly harsh, because I'm taking my own personal taste as opposed to, you know, critiquing quality.
Right.
In this instance, I think it's a combination of the two, and I'm going to give you my grades based on that, you know, with that as kind of the prerequisite on it. I'm not fond of the cover. I do think you had a point that if the background color at the top was different, it might make the name The Shroud pop a little bit more. It might make, I probably would actually obscure Spider-Man, which might be a plus. I think that could make it a little bit more compelling. I think The Shroud is, you know, kind of well rendered, but, you know, it doesn't jump out at me as, oh, you got to buy this book either.
Right.
I'm going to say a C. I'm going to say the cover is just, you know, it's competent, it's fine, but it doesn't really do a lot for me. The interior art, again, much like with you, that's where it takes the biggest hit. I think some of the layout work looks quality, and some of it really is, I think, poor. The actual style that it's rendered in is, in my opinion, you know, just not one that I like. The anatomy, which I guess goes to that style and goes to that 90s look, is weak. I didn't feel like the art really flowed very well for the most part, right, with the exception of a couple of, you know, pages where I thought the layout was better. So I'm going to say a D on the art. I don't think it's a failure, because, you know, you generally know what's going on in each panel, but it's kind of close to it, because it just really turned me off. The story is okay. I am generally a fan of Mike Barr. Not so much in this issue, but it, you know, I can see where the story is progressing. I see where he's setting up kind of a background and everything. But it feels a little, it almost feels like it's written in a way that was rushed, that he doesn't really, develop things the way he could. He leans on the flashback scenes. And I also think he leans on you knowing or having a familiarity with some of these characters like Cat and Mouse without really giving you any background. And it's an issue one. So I think that's a failure. And again, bottom line, this story did not make me want to read issue two. So I'm going to say a C- on the story. I think it's better than the art, but I don't think it's good. And I'm going to give the book a D. It really just didn't do it for me.
I think we're pretty close. I think we're pretty much in agreement on this one. Yeah, it was sad. I wanted to like it. I really did.
So now from that, I went to Mr. Terrific number one from November of 2011. And this is one that I don't really have a great familiarity with the character of Mr. Terrific. I've seen him in different things. I know who he is. I'm intrigued by him a little bit, being the third smartest person in the DC universe. I kind of think it's cool. And just in case people are listening and don't know, number one and two are Lex Luthor and Bruce Wayne. But he's the third smartest. And it's apparently it's a well-known fact around the world, because he actually says that in this issue at one point. So the story opens. Oh, well, actually, let me give you a little background here. The cover artist is J.G. Jones, and I guess inked by Laverne Kinzerski. It's written by Eric Wallace, who I'm not really familiar with. It's penciled by Gianluca Gugliotta, who I'm not really familiar with. Inked by Wayne Foucher, whose name sounds familiar, but I'm not really familiar with. Colored by Michael Ataye, who I'm not familiar with. And lettered by Dave Sharp, who I'm not familiar with. Oh, and it's edited by Joey Cavallari and Kate Dore, or Dume, who I'm also not familiar with. So this is basically a team that I know nothing about. the cover shows Mr. Terrific and his floating balls with kind of a computer a printed circuit behind him. And it's clearly pretty much a computerized finish on it. But it looks cool. I kind of dig the cover. The story opens in London, where Mr. Terrific is checking out Dalton Technologies to see if they are supplying people with a biomechanical armor, where he is immediately attacked by Miles Dalton, who is in that armor. Those balls that he has, I just recalled now, they're called T-spheres, and they apparently are, they might be a deus ex machina, that they have all sorts of abilities that I'm not familiar with. But anyway, he's got the three of them, and he rides them over to the London Eye, which the London Eye, if you're not familiar with it, is a giant Ferris wheel for observation purposes. And somehow he magnetizes Dalton, who is then stuck on the wheel. We then cut to Holt Industries, where we're having a flashback about how he, at I guess 20 years old, had multiple degrees. He had won a gold medal in the Olympics. I mean, he had everything going for him. He had found happiness with his wife. But then as he's driving home, he sees her car turned upside down on the road. And she's on the road, and they're already saying, sorry, we couldn't save her, but she hasn't died yet.
So yeah, I thought that
they
was
gave up a little quickly. Anyway, she tells him to, not to stop teaching and educating the world. We cut to a funeral, and then, he's basically ready to cash in his life and commit suicide, when all of a sudden someone appears in his lab and telling him not to give up, and then identifies himself as his son. Cut to the present, where Mr. Holt, Michael Holt, is sitting with a an attractive young girl who apparently is, I believe, a supermodel who's rich. And she's on his couch and they're just talking and they're discussing that there's a presidential campaign dinner that he wants her to attend with him. Cut to a cafe in downtown Los Angeles where a guy is finishing his meal and then all of a sudden gets some sort of a high-pitched sound that affects him. He just kind of insults the waitress and then goes out onto the street where he takes a homeless guy and snaps his neck, saying, "Problem solved." He's arrested, but then he starts filling out paper with formulas that are way, way too complex, according to Michael Holt, who said these are differential equations, that the kind that would give Stephen Hawking a headache. So he's showing himself as way beyond his own abilities. Holt then uses a dimensional portal and he's trying to figure out what's going on, but we cut to the Conscientia Institute in Santa Barbara, California, where that dinner is going on. And the young girl who was there as Michael Holt's date is approached by another young girl who apparently has her eyes on Michael and sees this other girl as a threat. We cut to Michael speaking to the senator. He's telling him basically that, you know, their politics don't align, but there's things about him that make him want to support him. When all of a sudden we get another high-pitched squeal, which now affects Michael, who is ready to kill the senator. And that's where we end this issue. Now, unlike the last book that we just did, this intrigues me and makes me want to read issue 2. Again, I'm not totally familiar with the character of Mr. Terrific. I know of him conceptually, but I've never really read anything to speak of with him in it. His predecessor, the other Mr. Terrific, my only real knowledge of him was the issue where he gets killed in Justice League. Right. So it's, you know, this is an, you know, an open area for me, but reading this issue, it intrigued me and it makes me want to go on to issue 2. So again, a big plus over the previous one. The artwork, I find the artwork to be compelling. It's not necessarily my favorite style because it's just a little, it just feels a little bit too computerized, that it feels like the colors and the, and some of the inking is, you know, probably retouched on the computer as opposed to hand rendered, which is more my style, but it's fairly easy to follow what's going on in a fairly complex story. The details look pretty cool. So overall, I dug this. I thought this was a pretty good issue. Had you read this before?
No. No, I had not. I was aware that it was out there. I every once in a while, I see issues of this in the dollar bins or you know, the cheap bins, and I've been tempted to maybe scarf it up or what. I gotta be honest. I didn't really dig this, but I suspect a lot of my issues with this is that this is set in the new 52 continuity, and so it kept butting up against my continuity brain. I'm woefully ignorant and you know, by choice, of the new 52, because I really didn't like that whole concept and what they did with that whole thing. So this left me with a lot of questions and a lot of like things that bugged me, but I think they're probably new 52 related. So first right off the bat, the girl that you said was, you know, like his girlfriend, the white girl, the model in his apartment, that's Karen Starr. But is she Power Girl in this continuity?
I don't,
because that, I think that's who she's supposed to be. Or I mean, at least that's, you know, because he calls her Karen. And then she says something about, he asks her, he says, "How long are you in LA for?" And she says, "Just a day or two, Starr wear business." And it's spelled, you know, S-T-A-R-R, which is how Karen Starr spelled her last name. Now, Karen Starr is Power Girl's secret identity in, you know, I don't even know what you would call it these days. The, you know, the regular Marvel, or excuse me, DC universe, you know, the pre and post crisis DC universe. But I don't know if that means she is also Power Girl, because I don't know if Power Girl was even a thing. See, I don't know if the JSA was a thing in this particular continuity. Because let's see, I have to pull up my notes here. I made a note about something. Oh, yes. There's a comment made in this where Mr. Terrific says something about brain transplants. And damn, I wish I'd made a page note number on it. There was, I can't remember where in the book he said it, but he was trying to figure out, oh, because the guy, all right, so the guy in the diner, he, you know, after Mr. Terrific gets, you know, is told about those formulas and everything, he's researching the guy. And yeah, he says that kind of intelligence doesn't appear overnight. Add to the fact that successful brain transplants aren't possible given current 21st century technology. Well, that got me to thinking, is the JSA part of this New 52 continuity, because one of the JSA's biggest bad is the Ultra Humanite, and that's his entire shtick is brain transplants. So that there was that sort of thing where it kind of took me out of the story. Like, I don't even know, like, I you know, I don't want to have to do tons of homework to figure out what the continuity is with the story that I'm, you know, that I'm reading or whatever.
Well, the other thing to give you a little background really quick on that, in the New 52, I did not care for what they did with the JSA. They kind of made them, they almost made the JLA the older team and the JSA the young team. So I guess that continuity was wiped out as far as the Ultra Humanite, and he had not yet appeared in this particular continuity. So I guess, yeah, you know, that particular fact didn't occur to me until you just started bringing up, you know, oh, they say that's not possible. So I guess I can wipe it out with the continuity they had going there, but I did not like what they did with the JSA. So I
right.
kind of agree with you, disagree with you at the same time.
The other thing was, all right, so after he takes out the armored bad guy at the beginning of the story on the London Wheel, which I had to say, I thought that was kind of neat just because I've been there. So that was kind of cool. But there's the, you know, the passengers on the wheel. One of the guys says, "Nice work, mate, got a name." And then Mr. Terrific says, "Mr. Terrific, some people call me the third smartest man in the world." And that took me right out of this, because extremely intelligent people, for the most part, they don't typically brag about being smart. You know, they're usually...
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, maybe it's not across the... I don't know. But with this particular character, and again, this is, you know, this is a different continuity, so maybe he's being written a different way. Maybe this particular Mr. Terrific is more cocky and maybe he's more of a braggart or whatever, but the Mr. Terrific I'm used to from the JSA, he just wasn't like that. You know, yes, he was smart and everything, but I don't remember him being a braggart about it. You know, if anything, he would kind of downplay it a bit. So that, I don't know, that bothered me.
Off the top of my head, I'm just thinking of Tony Stark in the MCU, who's always talking about how smart he is.
Well, that's true. But I don't know. I guess it goes more towards my expectation. I think that was ultimately my problem with this, is that I had certain expectations of this character going into it. And with this being a different continuity, I think I was supposed to, discard those. But then that makes me wonder, why does this guy even have his own series to begin with then, if you're not going to go off his name recognition and, you know, because I don't think he's that big of a character yet to where you could have him launch his own new series without the people that were already kind of pre-invested in him from the old continuity to support it. I don't know. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I get what you're saying. When the New 52 first started, I tried to keep an open mind about it. Unlike a lot of people who just wanted to be dismissive of it the way they were dismissive of Brand New Day with Spider-Man. But, you know, I tried to let myself get a little bit excited about it. And obviously they came out with 52 new series. So, you know, they did have to spread it a little thin as far as which books they were going to go with, because, right, you know, 52 is a lot. I thought a lot of the series, not all of them, I thought a lot of the series started out very promising, and, you know, but it's a flawed concept, because it's almost like, you know, well, we're going to start new continuity, but then, you know, you still fall into the same pitfalls the old continuity had. So you're better off just trying to work it out, as in my opinion. And you maybe, you know, you have individual things where you try to fix any continuity glitches with certain characters or certain teams. I find that to be a much more compelling thing as a continuity nerd of sorts. The New 52, they tried, you know, except for Batman and Green Lantern, we're starting everybody from scratch.
Right.
And you know, again, I tried to keep an open mind, and I read a lot of the issues as they came out. This was not one of them at that time, but I had read a lot of them, and I thought a lot of them had promise, but again, it was a flawed promise, which I think is what you're seeing here, is the flaws in the promise. For this particular issue, because I don't have a lot of familiarity with Mr. Terrific, I kind of read it in a vacuum when I read it for today. So I felt like, I think I was more open-minded because I was reading it in a vacuum. If I had come in there with any preconceived notions of the character or the continuity, I think I probably would have the same issues you're having. But overall, like I said, I kind of dug it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think at the end of the day for me, I think my continuity brain just got in the way, and my familiarity with the character, because I really like Mr. Terrific, but I like him from the JSA series and the way he was portrayed in that. And so this iteration of him just sadly feels out of character to me. And I can't quite put my finger on why I think so. But yeah, I don't know. It just, I wanted to like it more than I did. I didn't hate it by any means, but I also came to the same place at the end of the issue as I did with the Shroud one. I was like, eh, I don't know that I really want to keep going with this. You know, it just, I don't know. It didn't do it for me either. There wasn't enough of a hook for what was happening and everything. So yeah. Sorry.
Well, see, I thought this issue, in my opinion, I thought it had very little in the way of character moments for Mr. Terrific. I thought they gave you more of the broad strokes of his background, and my anticipation would be we'd get more character moments as the story went on. Now, I am, as I may have mentioned, I am a little unfamiliar with this particular creative team. So I don't know if they, you know, if there is a history of just doing bombastic action without character moments, or if we were going to build up to that. It does make sense to me to give the history of the character and familiarize yourself with just his situation in life and all of that, and then work your way into the character moments, because sometimes if you jump into those too quickly, a reader who doesn't know the broad strokes would be kind of lost. So, again, I would be hoping that issues 2, 3, 4, and however long this went on, would have the character moments that would make it more compelling as it went on. But I do see where the, you know, the broad strokes of giving you the history of this character, why he's in the situation he's in, is kind of important to a new reader, which is, you know, effectively what I was in this.
Right.
So, you know, overall, like I said, I dug it. I thought this was a pretty good issue, and I am more compelled to want to see where this series went. I think, you know, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think this went maybe 6, 8, somewhere around that number of issues.
8 issues, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, you know, to read 8 issues, I think I can probably squeeze. Where I can't squeeze 4 issues of The Shroud in, I could squeeze in 8 issues of Mr. Terrific. Although there is the possibility that at any point along the run, I could, you know, issue 2, 3, 4, whatever one, there's a point potential for I read an issue and say, you know what, I'm done. You know, right. if they don't give me more and they don't give me what I'm looking for. So it's not that, oh, slam dunk, I need to see more of this, but I'm curious to see more.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking here at the credits of the writer and the primary artist on this, and yeah, nothing really jumping out at me, to be honest. The writer Eric Wallace, the totality, the some of his credits on at least just on Mike's Amazing World is it's not a whole lot. It's all, yeah, he did Final Crisis Aftermath. He did a run on the Titans. I'm not sure which Titans iteration this one is, honestly. I'm looking at the cover images, and I can't even figure out which iteration of the Titans this is. But, yeah, I'm not really familiar with this guy at all. And then the artist, yeah, he only has just very few credits prior to this series. So, the art, the interior art, it wasn't bad. It reminds me an awful lot of Paul Pelletier. It's not quite as refined. I didn't like the faces as much, but, you know, just the general artistic style reminded me a lot of him, and I like that guy a lot, so... You know, so art wise, I kind of dug it, but yeah, just the story just didn't grab me, sadly.
So I guess, you know, at this point, I guess we could rate this one. I thought the cover was pretty cool. It almost looks like the cover of a novel, as opposed to a comic book.
It
raised my curiosity. I think I probably would be seriously considering buying this on the stands. I thought it was pretty cool. I'm gonna say a B. It's good. It's not great. It's good. The interior art, I like the interior art. Again, not necessarily 100% my chosen style, but still, to me, very accessible. And I'm gonna say a B plus on the art. I thought it was really, you know, well done. The story, it presented everything the way I'm curious to, you know, it gave me enough of a background, and it gave me enough of a hook at the end to see where the story is going to go. So I'm going to also say a B on the story, and I'm going to give the book overall a B.
I like the cover as well. I think the cover is eye-catching. It's dynamic. I like Mr. Terrific. I even kind of dig this iteration of his costume, although I liked his JSA costume a bit better. But yeah, I've seen this around, and as I say, I've seen it in the discount bins and everything. And it was, you know, every time I saw it or saw issues from this series, I was always like, oh, let me grab. And oh, wait, no, New 52, and then I would just pass it right over. But yeah, I like the cover on this. I'm gonna say. I'll say a B on the cover, because I do think it's a pretty cool cover. Interior art, I think I'll go a B on that as well. I really like it. I like the styles that it reminds me of. My only criticism of the art is Mr. Terrific. Actually, some of the other character faces as well. Some of the faces are a little bit weird. And there's this weird, like almost like doughy thing that he does with some of the art, and it's most noticeable on the very last page, the splash page. I don't know if it's supposed to be some weird sort of perspective shot or what, but that image of Mr. Terrific on the very last page, it just looks really weird. He's got this elongated, doughy torso, and then his head is just kind of weird at the top of his body, at the top of his neck. It's like the upper portion of his torso, like somebody grabbed a hold of his head and just kind of stretched him up a little bit. It's just kind of strange looking.
But I don't know if him being kind of controlled by whatever this is, and he's distorting him a little.
That's the way I kind of read that. That's what I think the artist is going for, is a weird, like some sort of weird distorted perspective shot, but it doesn't quite work, at least not for me. But overall, I mean, that's a minor criticism. Overall, I thought the art was pretty good. So I'm going to say a B on the art. Where it just didn't do it for me was the story. I didn't find it compelling enough. And I think this is just where my continuity brain was getting in the way, because this is a completely different continuity. It's all New 52. I have only the barest passing familiarity with New 52. Honestly, I think the only New 52 stuff I ever read was Jonah Hex, which of course doesn't have any bearing on this because it's all for the most part taking place in the Old West, and then Aquaman, which is kind of off doing its own thing. So I don't think this is supposed to be the same Michael Holt from like JSA and all that. So for all intents and purposes, he's a completely different character. So it's probably not fair to judge him based on what I already know about the character. But that kept getting in the way for me. It's like I kept feeling like this is not Mr. Terrific. He wouldn't say this. He wouldn't act like this. And that just bothered me through the whole story. So unfortunately, it just interfered with my enjoyment of it. So story-wise, I'm gonna say a C- on the story. It just didn't grab me, unfortunately. And that's a shame, because I really dig this character a lot, and always enjoy when he pops up, you know, in different things, and I'm enjoying, you know, hopefully going to enjoy seeing him in the new Superman movie. So it's not a reflection on Mr. Terrific. He's actually one of my favorite JSAers, but this solo book, I just didn't really care for it. So overall grade for me on this, I'm going to be generous and just say a C- on it. So yeah, there we go. But I'm happy to have checked it out.
All right. So that'll do it for today and our, I guess, initial venture on a new recording platform. We'll see how this works out. Either you'll hear it, which means it worked out fine, or you won't, in which case you'll be happily ignorant of this whole thing. But in the meanwhile, Scott and I, or any two people, will be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.